Holden's theme for the summer has been In the Image of God, In the Image of God. And under Holden's theme, my Bible studies for the last 2 weeks, or in these 2 week period of time, have been under the theme of Images That Transform. And under that, every day I pick a different image to look at. And today, the image is the image of light. Let's begin with prayer. Oh God, you are indeed the light of the world. We would ask that today, in this hour, your light would shine upon our endeavors as we look at the scriptures, that through these written words, you might speak to us your word, a living word. We would ask that as we hear the light and are invited toward it, we might take the risk of embracing it and dispelling yet a little more darkness in our lives. This we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. In order to start us today, what I need to do is give you a little bit of Old Testament or First Testament background, because it will show, or it will set the scene for the story that we're going to look at from John chapter 9. The story we'll look at today from John chapter 9 is the blind person at the pool of Siloam, or who was sent to the pool of Siloam. And in order to, I think, kind of come into kind of a running start with that, it would be kind of wise to take a look at some First Testament understandings of how Jewish people conceived their world. And if you want to turn to Leviticus chapter 11, you can, because that's what I'm going to be speaking about for a second. Jewish people divided their world into clean and unclean. The role of the people of Israel was that they were to be priests among the nations. They were a chosen people, but it wasn't just because they were so chosen they could just stand on their laurels and just look at everyone and say, look at us, aren't we special? Rather, they had a special task to do. And that task was to be God's people in the world so that people seeing them and seeing their lives and how they live would be drawn to worship God, Yahweh, of Israel. As priests, you might realize or be able to understand fairly quickly that that usually means a different kind of lifestyle. To be the people of God, we as Christians even say this among ourselves, we're to be different than other people. Not different in a bad sense, but different in a more positive sense. We have that feeling about our role. The same is true for the people of Israel. As priests to the nations, they should live lives that were extraordinary. Not necessarily in holiness and sinlessness in that sense, but at least in being God's representative and being the ones through whom God was reflected. There's that theology that goes along with that priesthood was the first types of things that began to divide things into two categories, things that were clean and things that were unclean. I'm going to turn this over, this board over in a minute so I don't want to tighten it down too hard. But this theology of priesthood of the people of Israel that divides itself into clean and unclean were theological cleans and uncleans. But along with the theology of the day, there was a science of the day. People's science isn't based like ours, where I think our science methods largely are a hypothesis and then you test it out and whether or not it holds water or whatever it might be. And then we come to a conclusion about that and then have a some kind of postulate or something that, you know, is derived from that. Their science is a little different. What would it be based on? What did they have to work with? Science of people who lived in 2,000, 3,000, 6,000 BC. Okay, and what about, say, the sun and stars? How did they get to know those sun and stars? They have telescopes?
No.
What they could see, what they could do, what they could hear, what they could smell. The science of the day is based on cause and effect. For every effect, there has to be a cause. And sometimes when the effect couldn't find a cause, they were really mystified by that and usually scared by it. They didn't understand, why does this happen? So this began also dividing things into things that could be understood, clean, and things that could not be understood, unclean. There was no moral significance attached in the earliest of times to clean and unclean. That came later. It actually begins showing up about in Leviticus, when the system of clean and unclean first comes to print. It existed a long time before that, but the book of Leviticus begins to write it down. In chapter 11, you begin to see that animals are divided into clean and unclean. Animals that have split hooves and chew the cud are clean. Animals that have split hooves and do not chew cud are unclean. Why? What do you know about eating pork?
It has to be cooked a lot.
Okay.
To kill the...
Yeah, the... Yeah, those things. Yeah. In the laws of cause and effect, when they ate pork and got sick and died, what was it caused from?
Unclean.
It had to be unclean. Something mysterious. I don't understand. It's unclean. A lot of those same critters that have the split fork thing and all of that don't chew cud are in the same kind of camp. They tend to fall more in the camp of rodents. Okay? So you tend to look at some of those things, and you can look at other things. There are other things that are unclean. What are the things that you know from the scriptures referred to as unclean? Or that you know about Jewish people that have called unclean?
Well, swine.
Okay, the pork.
Yeah.
Other things?
Shellfish.
Same thing. Okay, what other things?
Any non-scaled fish.
Okay.
All the birds that are...
Okay, other birds that feast on meat, largely. Okay, sometimes it doesn't quite fit our understandings of science in that way so perfectly, but we're starting to see cause and effect behind clean and unclean. And then you put the theology of the priesthood and so forth, it meant that I, as a priest, need to live very differently. So there's certain things I can do and be clean, and certain things I can do and be unclean. And there are relationships I can have to be clean, and relationships I can't have because I'll be unclean. And what unfortunately happened to that is that the priesthood did exactly what it usually does, and it made them feel exclusive. And so we can't even have anything to do with the Gentiles because they are unclean. But women could be unclean at times, during the birth process in particular. Think about cause and effect. How long did it take them to figure out from the time of intercourse 9 months later, that had something to do with baby? It took a long time, that cause and effect. And by that time, there were all kinds of, you know, mysteries. All of a sudden, this woman starts getting bigger and bigger, and all of a sudden, she has this baby. What did we do? Where does it come from? I don't know. God must give it. Okay? And so all of that. Blood, very unclean. Because life was considered to be in the blood. So you don't eat blood, you don't touch blood, and all kinds of things about blood. Dead people are unclean. Corpses, don't touch a dead person. The story of the Good Samaritan, you better read it with new eyes. It's a story of clean and unclean. The Samaritan is unclean. The priests and the Levites are clean. But the person laying by the side of the road might be unclean. That's why they walk around to the other side. Because they can't risk the uncleanness that would take them out of being able to be priests and sacrifice at the temple. Their love for God was compared against love for neighbor, which is the story just preceding it. And in this case, they choose love for God over love for neighbor. But the Samaritan is the one that says love for neighbor. But before you think you get too smart on that one, comes next the story of Mary and Martha. And Martha's loving her neighbor to death, making everything. Jesus, what am I going to do for you? And Martha does what? Loves God. Oh, it's complex being a Christian. Because the system of clean and unclean doesn't work for us as well anymore. Other people were considered unclean. Anybody they couldn't explain. Lepers. Couldn't explain that. They knew they had to put them aside, but they were unclean. Okay? Today's story is going to have something about unclean. It's not going to use the word, but it's there. So anyway, the world is divided for the Jewish folk by this time into clean and unclean. The Gospel of Mark is the gospel where Jesus takes on the system of clean and unclean. Everything you look at in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is talking to an unclean this and an unclean that. The priests were the ones that got to decide clean and unclean. So when Jesus begins talking about this and taking it apart, not so much the structure that it's bad to have things that are clean and unclean, as much as what it did to people. When the system was mercilessly followed, people were ostracized and hurt and destroyed. The woman with the hemorrhage, okay, put aside for 12 years, shut up in her house. When she went out to risk touching Jesus' robe, the risk to her was that she could be stoned because she would spread her uncleanness among the people. It was contagious. So the story of Jairus' daughter, which is interwoven with that story, is the story of a very clean daughter of the synagogue and a very unclean woman. And Jesus makes them both daughters. And the priests don't care for the way Jesus handles this unclean, so they're out to get him. Okay, the priests killed Jesus, not the Pharisees. That's found in Mark, it's found in all your Gospels. But read carefully. So clean and unclean has something to do with our lesson for the day. It's a system. It's a system that tends to bring people into less and less acceptance in the community and finally being outcast. The whole economic system was based on this. The people at the top who were the landowners also were people who had livestock, like sheep. Sheep are not an unclean animal. They have split hooves, but that you could. But shepherds are. Shepherds are unclean. Why? Not because of their association with the sheep, well, it's alive. Hint, hint. Yes,
yeah. Their job.
Yeah, what does their job entail?
Herding the sheep.
Herding the sheep. And where do those sheep wander?
Other
people's property. And they're stealing. What else do they do with sheep?
Well, they help with the birth process, so I suppose it'd be...
And blood. Yeah. What else?
And death.
And death. It was just... They were exposing themselves to uncleanness all the time. This was a lower class profession. The people who owned the animal, they hired people who could afford or who were willing to be unclean and cast out. So when the angel appears to the shepherds, there's a statement being made there. Now, let's turn to John 8. Let's start. Actually, let's start right to John 9. I won't continue too much of this. I think what would be wise is for us to read this immediately. And so, let's do it this way. We need a reader from 1 to 12. Anybody? Hand? Okay, got it. Someone from 13 through 23, 13 to 23. Thank you. Someone from 24 to 34, please. And 35 to the end. All yours. Let's do it.
As he passed by, he saw a man blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." And he said this. As he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of his spittle and anointed the man's eyes with the clay, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar said, "Is not this man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He said, "I am the man." And they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know."
Excuse me. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. The Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" There was a division among them. So they again said to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eye. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him."
So forth the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see." He said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you too want to become his disciple?" And they reveled at him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are the disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is a marvel. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if any one of you is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man was not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out.
Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he whom speaks to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, and for those who do not see me may see, and that those who see me see may become blind." And some of the Pharisees near him heard this, and they said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains."
Okay. One of the statements I could make about the Gospel of John is that John has a surplus of meaning. What would that mean to you if I made that statement, that John has a surplus of meaning? Anybody?
More meaning than you get.
Are you referring to yesterday's? I think probably the most complex chapter in John is that fourth chapter, the woman of Samaria, because there is so very much there. My apologies to you if I zip so quickly through that so quickly that you didn't get to see everything that was there. But you get to take that home and do a little more with it on your own. One of the things, just in referring back to yesterday, that I did not do very clearly is give you the reference as to where you find the five husbands, the five nations. If you weren't here yesterday, sorry, just give us a minute to do a minute of unfinished business. It is listed in 2 Kings 17, the five husbands and the false gods those nations brought with them. So that's where that comes from.
What was the reference again?
2 Kings 17. And I don't remember the verse. 24 through 31. Good for you. And actually, over on the other side, you'll see. But they brought false gods. If you read that chapter, it'll help you a lot understand how that interpretation got attached to the woman of Samaria. But today, we talk about John's surplus of meaning again. Because John is written at how many levels?
Two
levels. What's the bottom level? The stories of Jesus. This story of the man born blind, or the person born blind, is really found in Mark. It's a story about a blind person who's brought to Jesus. Jesus anoints, puts mud on their face and all of that, and they see a little bit, and he does it again, and he sees better. That's the story, I think, that John's referring to here. But John takes those stories, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke give, and John puts kind of over the top of them another level. And this level is kind of like John is giving little sermons, if you will, and that's probably the easiest way to understand it, on what all of these stories mean to John's community, to John's church, if you will. So the story of the person born blind, which you could read in Mark in probably 10 verses, has a whole chapter in John because John wants to show you all that it means. The Gospel of John is for mature Christians only. And that you really need to read John carefully. What are some of the things about John that make John unique as far as how it's written? What do you need to look for as you read?
Signs.
Jesus' miracles are signs, and they point to Jesus as somebody special about whom you must make a decision. What else?
Contrast.
Like what? Think of some.
Oh, light, dark.
Light, dark. What else?
Water and spirit.
Water and spirit and heavenly and earthly and every, lots of contrasts. You need to look at those as you read, John. Other things other than contrasts.
Different theologies.
Yeah, because John's composed of a whole lot of different folks in his community. And they all bring in their own mindset and their own theology. And that's part of John's gospel, is trying to get this group together to understand something in common. Or at least being able to relate to one another and understand theologies that they have. There's lots of ironies in John, too, where the person is given the truth in their mouth, but they don't realize that they're saying the truth. No? Are you greater than, you're not greater than Jacob, are you? Yeah. There's a couple of those in this chapter. Anyway, there's a lot of things to look at in John's gospel. And today, some of the new themes that we'll look at is the word sent is used a lot. It's under the question of, where does Jesus come from? And the answer is that Jesus has been sent. And that word sent is used not only of Jesus, but of Jesus' disciples who are going to be sent. They're going to be called apostles. And when Jesus dies, who next is sent? Okay, but who is sent when Jesus dies? To take Jesus' place, if you will. The Holy Spirit is sent. And it's the Spirit of Jesus. It's Jesus' presence that continues to live. Even though we don't see Jesus face to face, the Spirit is Jesus, the Spirit present with us. Some of the other things that we'll look at today will be, well, let me just turn the board over. Because I'm not going to give you a guided tour today. We're going to let you come up with some of these as you work with each other. The surplus of meaning, again, is so great. There we go, muscles. It's so great that what it'll do is allow you to just kind of pursue with a couple people, the themes you're interested in looking at from this particular ninth chapter. But some of the themes. Jesus, from whence are you? And I gave you just whole kinds of passages about that question in John. These are all John. It talks about Jesus and Moses' relationship. The Pharisees say, well, we're disciples of Moses. You're a disciple of this man. I don't know. So there's something going on here with Moses, and Jesus has something he wants to say about that. And then there's light themes. And then there's the big theme. One of the big themes in this chapter is to know. Knowledge is an incredibly important topic for John. If you're a Christian educator, you love John, because John is talking about different kinds of knowledge. And the knowledge that John is talking about in this chapter is the Greek word oida. It occurs 84 times in John, 11 times in this chapter alone. There are several words for knowledge in Greek, but this is the word that's not used as often. And it's defined as a knowledge that is related to sight. Remember kind of science of the people of the day too? They've used their senses to understand. And this is this kind of knowledge. How do you come to know something? Because I'm able to see it. I'm able to, and because this is a chapter about blindness and sight, this is kind of an interesting theme. There's something about being cast out of the synagogue, and that may intrigue you. So there's some passages there about that. Another theme that you might look at is Jesus is absent. He goes away for a while in this chapter. But does that seem to affect the story? And is it significant to us as readers? What does it say to you and me? And notice the blind person is sent to a pool called Siloam, sent. And he washes there and comes back. Interesting. Or you might look at the clean, unclean. See, the word's never used, but it starts out in verse 2 of that chapter. His disciples said, Rabbi, who sinned? this person or his parents is born blind. Cause and effect. The person's blind. We understand how he's blind? No, scientifically? Mm-mm. None of that kind of understanding. So it must be because somebody sinned. That's the system of clean and unclean. It's a little more sophisticated, but it's there. If this person is an unclean person, if he's conceived to be an unclean person, it's going to put itself out throughout the chapter in the way that he's treated and the way that people think about him. You might want to look at that. So I ask you to, I'm going to give you about 10 minutes or so. And if you include the new kids on the block so they feel, you know, that they can kind of catch up. This is a real hard one for them to come in the first day and kind of jump on. But after yesterday and you see what we did with the story of the woman of Samaria and how we saw very deeply significances, you might just want to pick a significance. Don't try to do the whole thing. There's no way. Pick what you're interested in. I have a concordance here if you want to look up even more references. I do ask you if you can stay in John or stay in the First Testament if you do that. I don't tend to use Matthew, Mark, and Luke to interpret John, or I kind of let each of them stand alone. You know, there might be one of these or others. And if you need some help, let me know and I can give you some. I'd like just like to, for us to do is see what we can come up with as a group, a community of our own, in looking at this two levels of John. And what does it say to you, and what are you interested in looking at? You won't get all the answers, I promise. Just do the best you can with what you got. This is how we'll do the debriefing portion. I'll just ask you for kind of what themes or whatever you worked on, and then you share with me and with us, not with me so much, but with us, what you've come up with. And if it's another group that's also worked on that theme, say, well, we worked on that theme too, and this is what we thought. And then I'll kind of throw in whatever I see, and we'll do what we can with the ninth chapter of John. There's lots of richness here. It's wonderful. Who worked on what theme, and what did you come up with? We don't need to take them in order. We'll just do it randomly here.
Well, we four worked on the first question.
Oh, okay.
Where whence are you from?
Okay.
And they didn't know. They wouldn't believe. He was Mary and Joseph's son, and that's they knew.
Mm-hmm.
But when he claimed to be God, the Son of God, I'm Jesus, something's wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We don't know where he's from.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that we're talking to him, so he makes it very clear of where he's from. And they, you know, he says, I am sent from the Father. And they don't seem to catch it, though. You know, he says it over and over. They don't catch it.
But we have feelings of discontent with some of our pastors. They do things that, why are we doing this? Who did this? Why in this?
Okay.
Where's it coming from? Where are they coming from?
Okay. Anybody else work on this thing?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he says he was a teacher from God, mm-hmm. and that he bears witness from God.
Okay.
He was above all from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Came down from heaven, but he also was son of Joseph, they said, and we don't know about that. It says that Christ, that we should know where Christ comes. We don't know where Christ comes from, but we know where he comes from. So he can't be the Christ, because mm-hmm. nobody's supposed to know where Christ comes from. I didn't quite understand that one.
Okay.
Fill me in when you get some understanding.
It's funny, at that modern slang term, I was just thinking about that right now. I know some students I had so often say, when they don't know, where's he coming from? I mean, they don't agree, and that's mm-hmm. such a standard thing. Where's he coming from? They mean, why does he get that idea?
Yeah, where's that come from?
Yeah.
Interesting. It's a really important question. Yeah.
In our church, it just happens that when I left, we were on ninth chapter, in our Bible study. We've been working in John, and the question always come to me, of all the examples that Jesus left, how come the Jews weren't all converted?
Yeah.
And I said that to a person, and they said, well, look around. We're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
We were mentioning, too, if a guy, you know, a kid living on the next block all of a sudden claims to be the Son of God, we're going to raise our eyebrows, too.
well stated. Okay. Seems to me this question of where Jesus comes from is a big one in this gospel. Probably because at the level of John's community, with all of those theologies, that was a big question. Exactly who is this Jesus and what was the significance of his life? Was he simply a teacher from God? Some could believe that. And those folks work in part of the Christian community. Was he more than that? And if so, how much more? In John, you have all kinds of images of Jesus the other Gospels hardly even hint to. But Jesus, you've got Messiah on every page, and Christ, you've got Lord, you've got Son of David, you've got Moses, you've got Abraham mentioned, you've got everybody mentioned, but who is this Jesus? This is the big question for John's community.
Is he a rabbi? Is he a teacher?
Is he a prophet?
Is he a prophet? These are the questions of the community. Now, what I would suggest to you is that in some ways, all these questions are raised until chapter 14 in John. What starts in chapter 14?
Jesus, we call it something with his disciples on Thursday evening of
purification. Right. It's called the high priestly prayer, isn't it, from 14 to 17? You know what that is? It's basically Jesus kind of giving the word in terms of who he is and what his relationship. He kind of answers all the questions the whole chapter raises, the whole book raises. I and the Father are one. I've been sent by the Father. Very clear. Very clear. You know, it's like what John does in his gospel, in my opinion, is that in the first chapters, he's raising all the questions of the community and letting the people, as they read the gospel, wrestle with the questions of their own day, and then gets to chapter 14 to 17, and then tries to come up with a way to answer them all, in a way to bring the theology together. Okay, we're going to move past this one, because we could stay all day on it, but there are some other themes. But they're a good one. Good eyes to see. What other themes? Who worked on what else?
We talked about the Pharisees, how they were against anybody that had the power that seemed like Jesus had. They wouldn't believe it, that Jesus had made somebody that was blind to be able to see. And they kept questioning the man, they kept questioning his parents. And the fact that the parents kind of withdrew, don't ask us about it. They were afraid of the power of the Pharisees to kick them out of the synagogue, so they weren't going to get themselves involved. Ask him, he's of age.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else work on that? The synagogue or related? You need to definitely look at, and I'm going to ask all the whole group to come to John 16:2 with us on that. This is, again, part of the high priestly prayer, as it's called. It's really a big sermon and a lot of dialogue between Jesus and the disciples, and it ends up with the prayer, I think, in 17. But in 16, verses 1 and 2, it says, I have said these things to you to keep you from stumbling. They will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, an hour is coming when those who kill you will think that by doing so they are offering worship to God, and they will do this because they've not known the Father or me. But I have said these things to you so that when the hour comes, you may remember I told you about them. When did the being put out of the synagogue start? Was it in the time when Jesus walked on earth?
No. Probably long before.
Actually, it was not. It was not when Jesus walked on earth, because Jesus has continued to go into the synagogues. He's teaching there. Paul, when he starts his ministry, goes into the synagogue, right? Mm-hmm. Right. The synagogue and the temple, those were still friendly places for Christians, for the first years of Jesus, after Jesus' death and resurrection. But there came a time when it began to be impossible for Christians who maintained that Jesus was more than a teacher from God, more than that, it became impossible for them to stay in the synagogue. And they were cast out of the synagogue. That phrase is used. What's interesting is that when you read the Gospel of Mark and you read some of the stories about clean and unclean, and especially when the unclean is in the form of what they didn't understand, so they just lumped everything together and called it a demon. What does Jesus do to the demon?
Casts
it out. This, again, is clean and unclean. The Christians that were beginning to admit that Jesus was more than just a teacher come from God or a simple prophet, making higher statements about Jesus, made the Jews in the synagogue very uncomfortable, because they knew about Abraham and they knew about Moses, the two figures in chapters 8 and 9 that we're dealing with here. But they couldn't quite figure out who Jesus was in that sense. So the ones that would admit Jesus to be higher than what they were able to allow Jesus to be would be cast out. They were unclean. And with that went everything that unclean meant. One moment, please. If you go back to chapter 6, verse 37... Do a little flipping around here. Sorry about that. We're in the same book. Make sure I got the right chapter here. Right, 36 and 37. Jesus is speaking to the disciples there. Would somebody read from their Revised Standard Version verses 36 and 37?
And I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and him who comes to me I will not cast out. That one?
Yeah. The person who comes to me, I'm not going to cast out. Whereas the people in the synagogues who believed about Jesus in a way that was not appropriate to the synagogue were cast out. Intentionally done there.
There are those who tell Jesus, or they who say of Jesus that he is a demon. And he says, how can a demon cast out a, you know, the...
Good. You're starting to pick up those interconnections, the intertextuality, as I call it, of the scriptures here. Yes, all of these images are used over and over again and played against each other for purposes that to help us understand. So who is it when, in verse 35, then back to chapter 9, I'm sorry, I'll get you back there again. Someone read that for us from their RSV, 9:35.
Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man?
When Jesus heard that he had been cast out, he comes. If you believe in me, I will in no wise cast you out. Kind of fulfillment, if you will. Just one insight, all we can do with it, I think, with the time we have. You heard the bell, it is 10. I'm going to continue on. So, but if you do need to go, feel free to zip out as quietly as you can. Now, there's someone that had raised a hand, and I said, one moment, please.
That was...
Okay, got it. Okay, want to make sure we cover it. Who's got another thing? Keep going. Yeah, go ahead. Who's got another thing?
The light.
Okay, what did you do with that?
Well, what did we do, James? Well, and we were, again, I think he was trying to say who he really was, mm-hmm. and they weren't believing, so it's just more of
saying?
Trying to say, yes, this is I am who I am.
There was an interesting passage talking about how people either will see through their eyes or in their eyes. Regarding the darkness and the light. Kind of different way of looking at it. It may be darkness around you, but by looking out, our eyes are light so that we can see rather than seeing the outside.
Okay. Is that significant, do you think, to this story about the blind person who sees and the Pharisees who say they see, but
do they?
The essence of the story is whether or not you're born blind or whether you become blind.
Those Pharisees had what we might call tunnel vision. They just focused on their point of view, and they wouldn't look at anything else.
In a sense, it's a spiritual light, in a sense. The blind man could see even before his sight was returned to him.
Well, how do you say that?
Because he had a spiritual insight that the Pharisees and the scribes and so forth did not have.
The blind person is coming to stages of seeing in this story. Mm-hmm. Starts out and he's asked, who is this person? Well, I've experienced a sign, if I may paraphrase it. It's back to the signs. He believes because of the sign. Something has happened to him, and this guy's a prophet, he says, to the Pharisees when they first ask him. When they come back and ask him again, he's able to state a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more until finally he makes a decision to really accept on the basis of his experience. He's able to risk the higher confession of who Jesus is, but it comes out of experience, not out of being told or anything else.
And I think it's interesting that last couple sentences, when he really gives almost a little lecture to them.
Yes,
it's remarkable
does.
That you don't even know about. I mean, he's sort of come a long way from just saying, this man did it to saying, how can you be so stupid that you don't understand?
Yeah, let's take a look at that. It starts in about 28. Then they, let's go up to 24 because this is about where this starts. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and they said to him, give glory to God. And I put in parentheses, but do it our way. We know that this man, this Jesus, I won't even call him by name, is a sinner. He answered, I do not know whether he is a sinner, but one thing I do know, I was blind and now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He said, second time they've asked this. He answered them, I told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciples, but we're disciples of Moses. Because we're teachers of the law. Okay? We're in Moses' tradition. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this person, we don't know where he comes from. The person answers, well, now here's an astonishing thing. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he's opened my eyes. It's a play on words. It's a very subtle difference in thought there. It's hard to hear what's being said there. It's like, you know, here it is. You're claiming to be ignorant, and yet I'm the one whose eyes have been opened. Now, you're betraying your ignorance, but it's my eyes who have been opened.
At this point, too, that the 547 comes into the picture.
With Moses?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
They believed in Moses so strongly. Mm-hmm. And yet Moses pointed his finger to Christ.
Right.
And they didn't believe that.
The Pharisees kept thinking that it had to be Moses or Jesus. But Jesus is saying it's Moses and Jesus. I've not come to take away the law. Jesus didn't come to destroy the law, friends. He didn't come to destroy the law. He came to fulfill the law. But let's do it this way. Let's look at it this way, because this is where I think you and I are Pharisees. I may be so bold to suggest that. I claim it for myself. It's my confession. Is that Moses gave the commandments. And around the commandments, which were given to protect the relationship that God had already created, talked about the covenant, I think, once this week already, that was God's gracious act of relationship. People didn't earn, Jews were not works righteous trying to earn salvation. That is not correct about Judaism. That was the problem Luther had with the Catholic Church. It's not the problem that the Jews had. We need to separate our two people here. The relationship was given, and the commandments were given to protect the relationship. The Jews were so concerned to protect the relationship, they held it that high, that around that they began to do case studies, if you will, about what does it mean to obey this commandment or that commandment. What does it mean then if it says you shall not kill? Well, does it mean that if an ox falls in the well that we should not rescue it on the Sabbath? Is that, you know, they began doing those kind of, and that's what the Pharisees were good at doing, interpreting the law and what it meant and the significance of it. They interpreted the commandments. They interpreted the scriptures. And in so doing, they put what they call a fence around the Torah, the fence around it, meaning that they're going to protect people from even coming close to possibly breaking it by showing them every possible way to keep it in obedience to it. This whole summary of these outside rules and whatever were called the tradition of the elders, if you will. We just heard it preached on if you were here Sunday. And what the Pharisees did was that they took the traditions of the elders and they made it equal with the commandments by saying that if you break our traditions, our interpretations of the commandment, it's as good as breaking the commandment. And the problem with that is that Jesus comes and is always showing them, folks, it's not the scriptures that are the problem, it's your interpretation. It's your dog fast holding on to it for everything you got, that the way we read the scriptures and the way we look at the Bible is the way it's got to be. You take a commandment, any commandment, give me a commandment, doesn't matter. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That's what it says. Don't take God's name in vain. But around that, we've made up all kinds of rules to say that this is what it means to take God's name in vain. That. And then when someone transgresses our interpretation, we cast them out as being the one that's violated the commandment. No, they violate our interpretation. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. This whole struggle in this particular story is because of a man who knows by what his experience and sight and experience with Jesus has led him to know, and the resistance of the Pharisees who know because we refuse to see. And no matter what we do, this man was not blind. Either his parents lied. He really wasn't born blind after all. We're going to go find that out. Well, guess what? Didn't work. On and on and on and on. You know something? I find myself more in the Pharisee camp than I do in the man born blind. Because I'm the one who claims to see. But I have to remember, I don't see very well yet. And I have to continually remind myself that I'm seeing a little bit more all the time. And so that when people come and challenge me and I feel threatened by what they say about my faith or the way I do or live my life, I have to stop and ask myself, what's really the ultimate important thing here? Is it my interpretation, or is it the fact that God's word is ever living and is going to change. It's going to continue to adapt, to show God's love and grace to people, so that my interpretations of the Word of God do not become merciless sledgehammers, like clean and unclean did. Clean and unclean started as a very good thing and ended up taking people and making them outcasts. Look at unclean and clean in terms of this person. Did anyone look at that by chance? Who is he? He's a blind person, but who does his neighbor say he is? He's a beggar. Because that's what it meant. He was stigmatized by that. And I don't know if I said that this hour or not, but I apologize for the fact that the physically blind have enough challenge to deal with without us thinking of blindness as having a spiritual deficit. And even using the analogy, it's really sad that we do that, because that's in a sense loading more into words than need to be. Or saying darkness and light, and we have people of color, or black and white, black is bad and white is good, you know? That's unfortunate for us that we have to use those images. I don't know how to escape it in this text. But, you know, what I'm saying here is that, going back to the text, is that, you know, this person who, this person who has become a beggar because of the clean and unclean, lower social status, had to beg, his neighbors don't even know who he is. See, they don't even see him. They've never seen him. He sat there for how many years probably, and they walked by him and never looked at him because he wasn't considered a real person to have to deal with. Wow, the significance is in this. One more and then we'll close. Anybody else? What other? Go.
I'm just going to talk about an experience I had.
Go for it.
And you study John and wonder why the people weren't all converted away to the Lord. This was a man that sold feet to me. I'm telling a personal story that happened to me. This fella come to my place, and I was buying feet for him. I was on the farm. And one day, and I don't think he meant to say it, and he says to me, I think you're a swell fella. And he knew what church I belonged to. And he says, because of your belief, you can't be saved. Now, how can one man judge another like he did? Of course, I was done with him, I mean, as far as that's concerned. But we still have this problem today. I mean, in Jesus' day, look at the problems they had. We still got those problems. When a man tells me I can't be saved.
Yeah. I know. Well, how I know? You see, that's why John has a different definition of sin for us. If you want to look at what Jesus calls sin in the Gospel of John, or when it's identified and said, yeah, you're still in your sins, as he said to the Pharisees at the end. Some of the Pharisees, in verse 40, heard him say this, surely we are not blind, are we? Jesus said, if you were blind, you would not have sinned, but now that you say we see, your sin remains.
Yeah.
The sin is that choosing to protect our status quo, typical ways of seeing the world, no matter what it may cost in terms of God's relationship to people in our lives. We become less gracious than God. And the final thing I'd like to, I think, do here is show the circle comes complete. What was the question the disciples asked in verse 2? Someone read that out loud for us.
And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?
Question of clean and unclean. We don't know why he's blind, so someone had to sin. Would someone please read out loud verse 34, this Pharisee speaking.
To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out.
What's the issue? The disciples come and say, Rabbi, who sinned? This person or his parents? Jesus says, neither. This is not a question of why is there suffering, but to what purpose suffering can be used, how we redeem it in our own lives. But the Pharisees are not able to allow what they see, that Jesus is bringing a new thing by saying that sin has nothing to do, or cleanness or whatever, has nothing to do with the person's physical blindness here. It has nothing to do with it. But the Pharisees go back and they revile the man, doing one more time the same thing that had been done in the first part, which is to keep him as an outcast, as a lower class citizen, by saying, "You were born in sin, how dare you teach us?"